Hello, IHHs. Welcome back. I'm Kate Thompson-Davey, and this is episode 3 of season 2 of It Happened Here, Friends, Family and Fraud, The Death of Dustin Blom. It's April 2013, and 37-year-old Dustin Blom is at one of his favourite haunts, a strip club called the Lollipop Lounge, deep in the heart of Randburg in northern Joburg. It's a well-known spot, infamous even, and just one of several bars and strip clubs where Dustin spends his nights these days, drinking heavily and probably seeking out some human connection. His home in Randburg's Sharon Lee suburb is just a 10-minute drive away, so it's an easy place for him to escape to when the house gets too quiet to be alone in. One of the dancers, a young woman whose real name, Dustin learns, is Mariska Robinson, soon becomes his favourite. She's younger than him, just 24 years old. Over the course of several visits, Dustin and Mariska's relationship develops into a friendship. And it quickly becomes apparent to him that she's a rather troubled young woman. Mariska tells him she's trying to get clean from her drug habits and wants to turn her life around. It's a sentiment that strikes a chord with Dustin. In the past few months, his own life has been completely turned upside down. His wife, Talita, died in hospital from complications after giving birth to their twins just a few months before. She had an amniotic embolism, which is a condition that leads to the collapse of the heart and lungs. And he was absolutely devastated by his grief, obviously, struggling to cope, let alone look after two newborns. So the babies have gone to live with Talita's family, and Dustin is often alone, processing what can only be imagined as an insurmountable level of grief. It's not the first tragic loss that he has experienced. Dustin's mom died of cancer when he was younger, and his father was in a horrific accident that left him with significant brain damage. He would later pass away as a result of this damage. Dustin and his sister Julie were very close, probably or maybe because of the traumas that they faced together. They also had extended family who cared for them, but the death of his wife in early 2013 sent him right back to that dark place, and he started to isolate himself from his family. As I said, his twins were being cared for by Talita's family, and although Dustin was caring and involved, he simply wasn't able to function enough to care for himself, let alone those children. It's perhaps understandable then why this, the loss of his wife at a time that should have been so joyful, has upended his life so dramatically. In any case, he's a broken man when Mariska meets him, far removed from the smiling and proud husband pictured in his wedding photos. I think maybe that it's this vulnerability that draws Mariska to him, and that leads the pair to becoming deeply entangled in each other's lives. Whatever it is, this friendship becomes significant quickly. The two of them reach a deal, that Mariska can come and stay at Dunstan's place while she tries to get her life in order. He'll provide her a safe place to get clean without having to worry about paying rent, so she can quit her job at the strip club and try to build a different future for herself. Now, I know what that sounds like, especially in a world where we have been over-sexualizing women to the point that people view friendships between people of different sexes as inherently romantic or inevitably physical. So let me note here that, according to various accounts, Dustin and Mariska were not in a sexual relationship. In fact, Mariska's boyfriend, 32-year-old Jean-Pierre Malan, who went by JP, often visited her at the house, where Dustin paid the bills to keep them both housed and fed. Dustin had come into quite a bit of cash through the payout of an insurance policy after his wife's passing, and probably because of the state of suspended grief he was in, he was spending that money on nights out and drinking. So perhaps this was one way that he saw to put the money to a better use, to help someone else get their life together, as his own descended into chaos. It seems, to all intents and purposes, to have been a completely altruistic act, or at worst, one driven by Dustin's need to not have to come home to an empty house anymore. At this point, Dustin wasn't working anymore. He didn't really have to because of the influx of insurance money, but also he was hurting and had found lots of bad ways to cope with that pain. I don't say bad ways to judge him or ridicule him for this. Firstly, we all have maladjusted ways of coping, and secondly, a poor coping mechanism is still a coping mechanism in the way that circumstantial evidence is still evidence. The hope, though, is always that we are able to shift from the poorer coping mechanisms to the better ones. So no, I'm not saying this to be judgy and shitty, but drinking all day and partying all night is understandable, but not ideal. One of Dustin's friends, Ryan Pickford, would later say, I quote, from what I understood, Dustin would wake up and spend most of his afternoons at the Dross in Olivedale, or he would socialize with these new friends. He was broken from what happened to his wife. He quickly started dabbling and spending time with escort women and in strip clubs. End quote. The Dross, if you're not familiar with it, is a pub franchise, and when his friend says he was dabbling, I take that to refer to drug use. But I guess for the sake of stigma attached to it, he doesn't say it outright. Dustin's drinking had really increased during this time, and he was starting to take more and more risks. In late May 2013, he'd even been pulled over and arrested for drunk driving. Instead of reaching out to family or another friend, Dustin rang his new roomie, Mariska, and told her where to find his bank cards. He gave her his PIN number and sent her off to get enough money to bail him out. And from then on, Dustin would let Mariska draw money with free rein, essentially. Unsurprisingly, though, over time, things started to get a little strained between the pair. Mariska wasn't really holding up her end of the bargain. She was still using various drugs, and Dustin was forking over a lot of money without the intended result of helping her get her life back on track. By September 2013, around 5 months after Mariska had moved in, it seems that Dustin was finally trying to take more of an effort towards sorting his own life out. He'd also started dating. This woman was another dancer and potentially an escort, but according to her account, they had fallen in love. She was one of the only, if not the only, client that had ever made that transition for her. In later records and in media coverage, this woman is not named. She's given a pseudonym, and sometimes she's referred to as Tracy and sometimes as Jennifer. And this actually creates a little confusion down the line. I just want to flag it here. For this story, I am calling her Jennifer, because that is the name given in the primary source that I used. But if you listen to the True Crime South Africa podcast episode on this case, I believe she's referred to as Tracy. So don't panic, though. What you need to know is that she was a pretty positive influence in Dustin's life, and she cared about him. She also knew Mariska. They had previously worked together for about 3 years, and she disliked Mariska enough that the first time she and Dustin spent a night together, Jennifer had insisted that it shouldn't be at Dustin's house. She did, of course, eventually spend some time at the house, but it's apparent that she never warmed up to Mariska. Jennifer felt that Mariska was manipulating and taking advantage of Dustin. She also knew that Mariska and JP, that's the boyfriend, remember, still used lots of drugs, and could probably guess that at least some of the money that they were pretty ostentatiously spending was being siphoned out of Dustin's account without his knowledge. We don't have a full account of what she really thought, but it is clear that she believed JP and Mariska were bad news, both generally and specifically when it came to Dustin. It's also possible that around this time, Dustin had some inkling of this himself. The reason I say that is based on what friends of his had shared about his state of mind at the time, that he was starting to emerge from the grief spiral to get some much-needed clarity on the actual state of his life and on what kind of a person he had let into his home. There's another reason that I believe Dustin would have been at least a little suspicious. By that stage, he would have had, more than a few times, woken up on his couch, confused and disorientated. Because, although he didn't realize it, Dustin Blum was being drugged. As I said, Dustin had started to pull back in terms of the free rein that Mariska had enjoyed with his money. He just wasn't as forthcoming with it as he had been earlier, and some sources say he was already planning on asking her to leave. Unable to get as much money out of him while he was awake, JP and Mariska resorted to spiking Dustin's glass of wine in the evening. They were using GHB, which is a drug you've probably heard of as one of the common date rape drugs used by predatory assholes in clubs and bars. In higher doses, GHB acts as a rapid central nervous system depressant, causing victims to pass out and to suffer memory loss. The drug is colorless and odorless, so it pretty much goes undetected until it's too late to do anything about it. The last thing victims are likely to remember is drinking, quote, too much, and then suddenly blacking out with no apparent warning. Even the hours leading up to the passing out, before the drug was consumed, would start being foggy or even completely missing. In Dustin's case, the dose they gave him was carefully calibrated to knock him out for just long enough that Mariska could steal his bank card and send JP out to draw money while Dustin slept it off. Text messages presented as evidence in court later showed that JP and Mariska had this down to an art form. She had his bank PIN, after all, and she knew the code to his phone. When the bank sent through a message about the withdrawal, Mariska would just delete it. And while JP was out, Mariska was at home keeping an eye on Dustin and messaging her boyfriend to make sure they'd have the time to slip his bank card back into his wallet before the GHB wore off. So when Dustin woke up, he'd be none the wiser that he had just been defrauded out of what would, over time, add up to a considerable amount of money. By the 16th of September 2013, it looked like the jig was about to be up. As I've alluded to, Dustin was in the early stages of what seemed to be a blossoming and loving relationship with Jennifer. And he was starting to regain some of that momentum and a little bit of direction in life. Jennifer could see that he really needed to go out to get out of the downward spiral he was locked in. And she and another friend of his, that's Ryan again, persuaded him to take a vacation to Bali to just get away from everything. Ryan's partner was a travel agent, and so they helped Dustin book the tickets, and he was going to spend some time with a mutual friend of his and Ryan's. Here is where that pseudonym issue becomes a problem again, because this woman I've also seen referred to as Tracy. It doesn't matter though, this friend of Ryan's ran a yoga practice in Bali, and all of them believed that it would be a good place for him to go away to and dry up, to spend some time out of the party lifestyle that he had been steeping in the months after his wife's death. He was scheduled to leave on the 17th of September. Ryan cautioned him not to mention the trip to anyone. He was worried that JB and Mariska would talk him out of it, or worse. He told Dustin, and I quote, "You are spending 15,000 to 20,000 rand a week, and you are like a revenue stream to these people," end quote. He couldn't have known just how prescient this warning was. Now, the next 2 days in the timeline get a little confusing. There's a lot to keep track of, multiple people in different locations, and there's a lot of contradiction when we get to JB and Mariska's later testimony. But let's start on the 17th. It's the morning and Jennifer is at Dustin's house alone with the terrible twosome. According to Jennifer, Mariska was pretty upset when she found out Dustin was going to Bali. Jennifer had told her this the day before, and, shocking, Dustin's passport mysteriously disappeared, presumably after Mariska heard about his plans. Now, I don't know for certain that Mariska took the passport, but it seems really likely, especially when you factor in that JP also seemed to have some sort of sideline in forged documents, or at least he used them a lot himself. When he was eventually arrested, he had multiple identity documents on him in different names, so he would certainly have had a use for a stray passport. But I digress, let's get back to the 17th. While Jennifer is over at Dustin's house, Mariska and JP invite her into their room for a chat. She notes that they seem to be in good spirits, and they have a lot of drugs in a small backpack, far too much for two people to reasonably consume. When she asks them if they are celebrating, Mariska chillingly answers, "We are going to have reason to celebrate." If Jennifer reads into this at all, she apparently doesn't mention it to Dustin when he returns later that morning. Dustin and Jennifer head out to the Dross for lunch with friends, and he tells them all that he's going to Home Affairs to sort out a temporary passport, having rescheduled his trip in the meantime. That evening, Dustin calls his friend Ryan to arrange to pick up the rescheduled ticket. He says he'll swing past in the morning of the 18th. He also drops Jennifer off at work that evening at around 6 p.m. Though neither of them know it, this is the last time that Ryan or Jennifer will ever hear from Dustin Blom. The morning of the 18th comes, and Dustin doesn't show for his meeting with Ryan. This is an immediate red flag for his friend, who knows that Dustin is a punctual guy who sticks to his word, even in the midst of his current chaotic life. When he can't reach him directly, Ryan phones around to their other mutual friends, but no one has heard from Dustin, and no one can get hold of him on the phone. Ryan even mentions his concern to a police officer friend of his, and according to one account, goes to the morgue to try and look for his friend's body. So clearly, they're taking this very seriously immediately. His instincts to take this seriously, these will turn out to be spot on. But sadly, he is too late. Because at some point in the early hours of the 18th of September, Dustin Blom was murdered in his own living room. Now, again, things get messy here, and JP and Mariska's testimony that they give are totally different. Let's start with Mariska's account. According to her, she was in her room at Dustin's house with JP getting high, when he decided he wanted to go draw some more of Dustin's money. In this universe, the one of Mariska's telling, she was reluctant to risk it because Dustin had already fallen asleep naturally, meaning that they couldn't roll out their usual strategy of drugging him and carrying out the theft while he was passed out. She was apparently worried that he would wake up and catch them in the act. But JP, she says, wouldn't be deterred. He told her he could put Dustin in what he called a sleeper hold, like what you see wrestlers do on TV, and that he'd be out cold as usual. Marushka says that JP went downstairs, and while she was hanging back, she heard some noise, like furniture being moved around, and then JP returned to tell her he was going to withdraw the cash. Marushka's version says that she did peek downstairs while he was out, and she saw Dustin lying on the floor with a bloody nose, but she didn't check on him further, despite the fact that instead of the usual 20-minute or so round trip, JP was gone for hours this time. When he eventually came back to the house, it was in the company of another man, Terence, who I sadly have not been able to find out any other information about. Marushka says Terence and JP told her to come downstairs, and they then informed her that Dustin was dead. She didn't believe this, or maybe she just wanted to check. She put her fingers under Dustin's nostril to check for breath, but he wasn't breathing, and it was at that stage that Marushka says she started to panic. She even says that she wanted to call the police to tell them that it was an accidental death, but JP told her that if she did so, he wouldn't be there when the cops arrived, implying that she was going to be the one pinned for the crime. JP told her he was going to pull Dustin's car, a brown Nissan Qashqai, into the garage, and that she would have to help him get the body in the boot. She says she mopped up the blood with towels after they dragged him across the floor, and then dumped the towels in a trash bag, which he left in a field opposite the house. Now, a teeny diversion here to say that this detail about the blood, it bugs me. If we are to believe that earlier she had seen him with a bloody nose but assumed he was out cold from a sleeper hold, well, it couldn't have been a lot of blood, right? Otherwise, she surely would have known that the whole encounter hadn't gone to plan. And she says towels as in multiple, so we're talking about more than a tiny trickle of blood, like you'd get if you had got cracked on the nose during a scuffle. I don't even 100% know what to think about the blood or what it indicates to me. It's one of those disconnect points, or points of disconnect rather, between her and JP's testimony, which I will get to in a moment. This diversion then is kind of a dead-end road, essentially, but it is a detail that twigs something for me, a detail that I have not found a satisfactory explanation for, either in the testimonies or in my own reading between the lines of those testimonies. Anyway, let's go back to Marushka's yarn. If she's trying to paint herself as some sort of victim in this whole thing, her next bit of testimony sure does not add to that depiction. After her supposed friend, Dustin, is dead by accident, misadventure, or intent, the pair, that's JP and Marushka, went shopping in the Qashqai, with Dustin's body still in the boot. She also testified that she waited at a hotel afterwards, while JP drove the car to the nearby Monte Cassino entertainment complex, where he left the Qashqai parked, body and all, in the parking area. And then, like someone deeply concerned or worried about the role in the death of her friend, she went gambling with JP. They're seen on video footage, laughing and joking and kissing while they spend her friend's money. As I mentioned, JP's version of events is completely different. JP says that he had no idea that Dustin was dead until the 19th of September. According to him, Marushka told him that she might have given Dustin a little too much GHB during their latest instance of robbing the man who had opened his home to her, and that she was pretty sure he was dead. She said she needed JP's help getting rid of the body. Now, I don't know about you, but besides maybe under really exceptional circumstances, I personally wouldn't just agree to help someone move a body, no questions asked. But JP, rocket scientist that he is, reckons that he had to dispose of the evidence because he was the one who supplied Mariska with the GHB in the first place. He does, however, seem to admit to at least being present at some point on the 18th, and forensic analysis shows that they, JP and Mariska, were messaging each other as part of their usual strategy to steal money. The two stories are worlds apart, and it's likely that we won't ever really know what went down on the 18th. What we do know is that there was more than enough forensic evidence to put both JP and Mariska behind bars where, frankly, they belong. Besides their somewhat confusing and convoluted trail of SMSs, there was also CCTV footage from Monte Cassino that tells at least part of the story. Specifically, JP and Mariska are seen pulling up in a white Volvo just after midnight on the 19th of September. Inside, the pair spent lots, thousands and thousands of Dustin's money, and they are clearly in a celebratory mood. They even, God help us, are seen at one point giving each other a high five, like kids that just got away with something, rather than two grown adults who just murdered someone who was supposed to be a friend. When questioned about this, JP said he was in a good mood that night, and that he had no reason not to be celebrating, because he had no idea that Dustin was dead at this point. He says that Mariska told him later, and on the surface, I guess, the footage seems to support that claim. Or, alternative reading here, perhaps he is just that unbothered by what he has done. No prizes for guessing what I believe. Later that day, around 2 p.m, we see Dustin's car pull into the Monte Cassino parking lot and get left there. This, according to JP, is after Mariska told him about the OD and he'd agreed to check on the situation with her. Unfortunately, there are no cameras on the level where the car was left, and the identity of the driver is never clear from the footage. But here is the biggest problem for JP's version of events. We would later hear from the medical examiner that Dustin's body showed signs of asphyxiation, with possible ligature marks, and that he had a fractured hyoid bone in his neck, suggesting considerable force had been applied to his neck when he died. The doc will point out that the body was in an advanced stage of decomposition, which does complicate her efforts to make definitive claims, but still, this was not an OD. So in a morbid way, it's another point for Mariska's version of events. On the other hand, it's also quite clear then that this was never a sleeper hold gone wrong. The ligature marks say otherwise. This was a violent and deliberate death. There were also footprints at the scene, that's in Dustin's home, that the police were able to show using Blue Star when they applied Blue Star to the floors. And there are two sets of prints. One from someone wearing shoes, and the other, later identified as belonging to Mariska, made by someone wearing socks. And before you get completely grossed out by that image, as I was, apparently those were made after she tried to mop up the blood. So thankfully, talk about small mercies, she wasn't running around the house in a pair of blood-drenched socks. Dustin Blom's body was only found on the 22nd of September, 3 days after the cash guy was left parked in Monte Cassino. It was a grisly discovery for the security staff, prompted by the stink of decomposing flesh that had begun to seep from the car, to the point that security guards in the lot started to notice. They ran the plates and found out that it belonged to a missing man. And with that, they opened the vehicle, and Dustin was found. This is the point that most people in South Africa first heard about this case. When news broke that the guards had opened the vehicle and discovered a body, it was a shocking and honestly clickbaity story. The body in the boot in the parking lot of the hugely popular Monte Cassino. Not only is it shocking because it's a well-known and for some loved destination, but also because there is a hint of, I don't know, mob moviness to it, I guess. The proximity of the casinos, the abandoned vehicles. I get the appeal of a news story like that. I really do. But I think now, after the fact, it is important to reframe the story from the perspective of someone like Dustin's sister Julie or his friend Ryan, who had been living in that awful mix of fear and hope for a few days. Ryan was contacted by the police officer friend that he had mentioned his concerns to. It was the kind of call he had been dreading, a request to come and identify the body. Dustin's body was already so decomposed that Ryan could only confirm that it was his friend from a distinctive tattoo. They had the answer to their questions, and it wasn't the good kind. Appalled by what he had just seen, Ryan and a group of friends took it upon themselves to call Mariska relentlessly. He'd been all over her in the days leading up to this, asking after his friend. But they upped the ante after his body was found, and finally, in response to this endless pressure and phone calls, Mariska went to the police on the 23rd. I don't know this for sure, and maybe I'm way off the mark here, but I do like to think that she was sweating bullets. But like most con artists, she thought she could get ahead of the story. She tried to make up a false alibi about being in Pretoria when the murder happened. The police, thankfully, were not buying it, and Mariska was quickly arrested. They punched massive holes in her bullshit story immediately and conclusively. Mariska, it seems, hadn't factored in the footage of her partying it up at the high rollers table in Monte Cassino, right around the same time that she claimed she wasn't even in town. So yes, a con man, but not a mastermind. Remember kids, heavy drug use will rot your brain. JP was arrested a few days later, in possession of those multiple forged ID documents, and like Mariska, he was charged with murder and robbery. Also like Mariska, he denied these charges, and between the two of them, their conflicting testimony dragged the matter out in court all the way through 2015, when they were both finally found guilty. JP was given a life sentence for murder and robbery and some other related charges, and Mariska 29 years on a range of charges, the most significant being accessory to murder. Meanwhile, Dustin is gone, deprived of the chance to get himself back on track. His children deprived of the chance to get to know their father. During sentencing in August 2015, Julie was given a chance to read a statement to the court. And I want to close out on her words. She said, "The loss of my brother has left me shattered. The hole left in the lives of all of us by Dustin's shocking murder is a void that can never be filled. He was," she said, "a devoted husband, loving father, caring brother, and loyal friend." I hope that that's the memory that she and the rest of his family hold tight all these years later. One last detour before I wrap this all up. There was a second court case linked to the defrauding and death of Dustin Blum. Four men were arrested and charged with fraud for racking up over 100,000 rands worth of credit card debt on Dustin's cards in the days after his death. They were caught on camera swiping his cards and arrested shortly thereafter. And because of this link, some media have suggested that there were stronger ties between J.P. Malone and organized crime. However, the frustrating thing is that I can't seem to find much more info about that case. I've looked everywhere, including on SAFLE, which is a local legal information database, but I cannot tell you the outcome of that case. We still have a long way to go in terms of digitizing our courts and records, so perhaps that's why this path led nowhere. If you know what happened here, please let me know. I would love to update listeners. And finally, I also want to remind you that my sources are always provided in the episode notes. But I want to give a particular shout out to Nicole of True Crime South Africa. Nicole did an episode on this case back in 2019, I think it was. And I also bugged her about the confusing names of the sources just before I started to record this, actually. And she kindly dug out her notes for me. Nicole's not only a great podcaster, but an incredibly generous person who has created a little community of South African true crime and creepy story podcasters. And I just thought I'd let you know that she's awesome, and I'm very grateful to have someone like her in this space. If you want to know more about the case, I recommend checking out her episode. That's it from me. Thanks, everyone. It Happened Here is a Ready Freddy podcast.